Right, welcome everybody to tonight's meeting for the Scrutiny, Regeneration and Development of the Market Hall Committee on this day, the 21st of September. I've got apologies from Councillor Arshad as far. Is there any more apologies off anybody? I don't think there was.
No more.
Right, so we'll go on to declarations of interest. Do any councillors have any declarations of interest to declare on the items under discussion this evening? Nope. Okay. Item 3, to consider any urgent business brought forward to the meeting under Rule 12. I'm not aware of any. Nope. Good. Questions from the public. We have not received any questions from members of the public either. Questions from members of the committee. I'm not aware there's any of those either. No. Quick. public minutes of the previous meeting on the 5th of July. I propose the approval of the public minutes from the previous meeting. Do I have a seconder for that? Mandy Swart, Councillor Shrive there. We will now go to the vote. All those for approving the minutes. Okay, I think that's everyone. Yeah, and none against. So we confirm the vote is carried. Oh, are you? All right, Tom, Councillor Hadley. Right, so scrutiny review programme update. We had an informal meeting earlier in the month to discuss the scoping paper, which Dan has kindly put together. To help inform this review, we have invited representatives from the co-op to attend the meeting tonight. Welcome Richard Bickle to the meeting. Richard is the Cooperative Development Advisor for Cooperative West Midlands, along with his colleague Jane Avery, who is a Cooperative Development Advisor for CASE, the Cooperative and Social Enterprise Development Agency in the East Midlands. Richard has had sight of the scoping paper, which Dan has already circulated previously. So I invite Richard and Jane to give a brief overview, and then there will be an opportunity for questions from councillors. Okay, Richard. Thank you.
Going red. Okay. Is that working?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so Cooperatives West Midlands is a network of all the different kinds of co-op in the region. It's not politically aligned and it tries to bring everybody together. And one of the things that we do is we've got a small budget to support the creation of new cooperatives across the whole of the West Midlands. What that means is that we can spend a little bit of time with groups who are looking at cooperative solutions in their neighbourhoods, in their workplaces, in their communities, at a kind of early stage. And if that looks like it's going to be successful, we can then refer that on partly to agencies like James, but also through Cooperatives UK to access up to 6 days of professional development support, which can help people develop a business plan and then go to the public or whoever it is that the audience is. So in terms of markets, there's a long history of cooperative involvement in market-type enterprises. I think the earliest that I'm aware of go back to 1928, when the WI, the Women's Institute, set up a markets department, which established a network of country markets in towns and villages all over the country, which were arranged as producer cooperatives where all the people who sell things on the market are members, and they organise kind of what in modern language we call pop-up markets in town halls or church halls or whatever, typically weekly. There are then cattle markets, which particularly in Wales and Scotland are often managed by local farmers through agricultural co-ops. There are market traders co-ops, particularly developing from the 1990s onwards, supported by the National Market Traders Federation, recently with support from Cooperatives UK. They typically have taken on the management of outdoor street markets in areas where the local authority perhaps hasn't been in a position to give the kind of support that the market traders felt they needed, which allows the local authority to derive a certain amount of income, but means that the hard work of kind of day-to-day organisation is taken over by the traders themselves. There's then a further group of markets, the best known of which is Radcliffe in Greater Manchester, where there's a community cooperative solution where a group of local residents and traders and other interested parties have taken over the management of the market hall, I believe on a lease from Bury Metropolitan Borough Council, that's really transformed that space into something which continues with the traditional market service of, you know, 3 days a week of a traditional retail market, but also adds elements of a food hall, which I believe has been one model that's been discussed in Burton, and also an event space, all in a kind of overall operation. That's been funded, as I understand it, partly by a community share offer where members of the public who care about the future of the market have been able to become members and invest in share capital, some of which has been matched, I think, through a project Co-opters UK run. And they've managed to transform that market from being quite a rundown and declining space into one which, even through the COVID years, I was looking at their accounts yesterday, is cash generative and a successful business for the future. I mean, I think, you know, Jane and I have got many years' experience advising and working with groups looking at different kinds of co-ops. And, you know, we're very happy to help if we can. I mean, do you want to say something about what co-ops are and the kind of different models?
Okay, so I've worked in co-op development since 1985. And people will say, well, you know, what does the model look like? What do we have to do? And the reality is that sort of my role really would be to work with the stakeholders to find out what it is that is wanted in Burton and wanted by the stakeholders, and work back from that to identify the most appropriate legal structure for them. So co-ops can take many different types of legal structure, actually. You can register a co-op through the FCA, in which case that model would enable the cooperative to raise money through cooperative shares, through the public, through owners. And very often they are very successful in terms, very often where there is a will or a desire to maintain or support a community asset. So they can take the form of, say, a community energy project. I was involved in with a school over in Leicester where they needed to replace old oil-fired boilers, and you know, the local authority just didn't have that sort of fund. The old system of heating was a huge drain on the budget of the school. So it was a little bit of very creative thinking with it on behalf of the PTA, the schools, and the parents and the community, and people who were just interested in swapping out oil-fired boilers for environmental reasons and replacing them with modern ecological boilers. They registered a co-op, had a share issue amongst all sorts of people who were interested for all sorts of reasons, either parents who wanted to see the budget of the school used for educational purposes rather than just heating the classrooms, and environmentalists who wanted to support a project that would, you know, be a cleaner, greener way of heating the school. So that was a sort of a share offer. A business plan was written, a share offer document was produced, so that people invested for various reasons but had a very clear picture of what the return on their investment would be over how long, and that was approved, it was written to a standard. So that was just one example. So a co-op can be registered for that purpose. If there are a group of traders, and we've worked with this model as well, that just want to preserve their working environment, and they want, say the management of the space has been traditionally the local authority, for example. The local authority, for various reasons, may want, I don't know if this is the case in this case, but may want to withdraw from that. We've worked with one, again, in Leicestershire. But they wanted to take over the management of the space, and that the legal structure there was what's known as a marketing co-op, a secondary co-op, where there was no profit motivation at all. In fact, the co-op didn't make any profit. The costs of running the co-op were met through the membership fee or the rent that the members paid, which covered their pitch plus a little bit over to provide the management of the space, and they then took over the management of their own space and preserved it for the community. So the weekly market continued, and one on a Thursday, and that was the model that was used there. So it really is dependent on what the need is for the community, for the stakeholders, and then we work with that, with a cohort, to develop the business plan, to see that that stacks up and that people know what they are buying into, getting into, what they're signing up to, and how the business will develop and work. And very often it can be a step change. So there can be a situation where there's been a managed decline, things do rumble on and sort of peter out. And it can be very regenerative, that people are energised and have a vision for the space that hasn't been realised for whatever reason by the previous way of doing things. So, it can be a very positive way forward. And actually, unless there is that energy, part of my job as an advisor is to really drill down and look into the reasons why people are doing things and look to a future. So a business plan isn't just for the short term, what's the issue today? It's what's the vision for the next 5 years, and can we build and improve on what we've got rather than just carry on business as usual, which often is a sort of a gentle decline, because that's kind of just prolonging the agony, really.
So I think it's fair to say that the most successful cooperative solutions are the ones that arise from a group of citizens who are passionate about a particular service or the future of their workplace or whatever it happens to be, who come together to create a business that can deliver on their objectives and on their vision. It's much more difficult if you try to kind of do it on a kind of top-down basis. However, if we think about the way that, for example, local authorities deliver services, there are ways that you can behave more cooperatively with a little c without necessarily incorporating a cooperative as a legal structure. Because I think, my engagement with local authorities over the years, I look back when I lived in Norfolk, both Norfolk County Council, which was traditionally Conservative run, and Norwich City Council, which was traditionally Labour run, both shared a kind of culture of the local authority having a relatively paternalist approach, doing things for citizens, really trying to look after people, which became much, much more difficult as financial pressures and central government funding cuts and, changes in the tax system filtered through. And I think there is a possibility, I think some public policy people call it co-production, where you kind of reimagine the role of the local authority as doing things with citizens rather than doing things for the citizens. So you might still have a service which is managed by the local authority, but the way that is delivered tries to engage citizens, tries to get their views, tries to give them a voice and a say. And that can be a way of delivering a better public service, but it can also be a step towards those citizens actually taking on responsibility directly, for example, through a cooperative structure. I mean, it all depends on the particular circumstances.
Any comments anyone would like to make?
Well, that may or may not be working. It's flashing at me. Can I ask for a point of clarification?
Yes.
In your secondary cooperative example, you indicated that the stallholders, they pay their rent for their stall as well, but they also make a financial contribution towards the management structure.
Yes, that's usually how it works. And so if the costs are, say, £100 to provide a secretarial service or whatever, and there are 10 stallholders in this case, they would pay £10 each. If there were 20 stallholders, they would pay £5 each. And that's, very simplistically, the model of a secondary cooperative. And it would be the co-op that then has the contract or signs the agreement to lease or whatever the space, and that may well be part of that management fee. So so secondary co-ops are useful for taxi co-ops. I've set up a taxi co-op. Actors co-ops, where they are individuals, they are self-employed people, or partners, or you know, there could be members of the co-op that are limited companies, but they use the services. That's the sort of the key. They use the services. It's a mutual need, and they pay for that. So that is a not-for-profit model for the cooperative.
I mean, agricultural marketing is another is another common example where, you know, farmers will club together to market their produce, maybe store their grain collectively, and they'll find an equitable way to kind of share the costs of that and then share the benefits when that grain is sold.
Councillor Hadley.
Yeah, that's good. My question is, it might be different for different co-ops, but does it mean that all stallholders need to be part of this cooperative, or could you have there's a working cooperative committee and then have separate stallholders who don't want to be a part of the co-op?
So I think there are two parts to that question. One part is, does everybody have to be a member? Well, strictly speaking, probably not. Although I think it would probably get quite difficult if you had some people who were and some people who weren't, because that would start to feel like kind of first and second class kind of people. The question on who's on the committee is a different question, because effectively there are two ways of running a co-op. One is a completely participative way where all the members turn up to a regular meeting and make the decisions together. And the second way of doing it is the members elect a committee, the committee decides things and or may employ a manager. The switch between participative and representative democracy, if you like, is often a function of scale. So, you know, small groups will almost always operate collectively because it would be silly not to if there are only half a dozen of you. Conversely, there are very, very few examples of co-ops that have got, you know, more than 20, more than 50 members who still operate collectively. I mean, I think the exception that proves the rule is Suma Whole Foods, a big whole food wholesale co-op in West Yorkshire, who've got over 200 members, and they at least claim to operate on an entirely collective basis. But in practice, they delegate to the people working in a particular part of the business. the responsibility for running that part of the business within kind of delegated authorities agreed by the members once a year in a general meeting. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. And I think practically, say you set your rent at, again, I'll use easy to divide figures, say £100 a year, that figure would include the rent of the store and your membership fee. So there would be no benefit really to not being a member. You get that as part of.
I mean, I've been working with recently a group of artists in Birmingham who currently have a shared studio space, and at the moment one of the artists is officially has a tenancy for the whole space, and actually she and the other artists would prefer, it's like a big studio in an old Victorian factory, they would much prefer to share that equally, so they're all, there are eight of them, so they would like to all be equally responsible rather than all the responsibility falling on one person's shoulders. But one thing that I'm going to suggest to them is they might want to consider requiring all those people to put a modest amount of money. It might be £100, it might be a few hundred pounds. But to become members, that everybody has a financial stake of some kind, partly so that they actually recognise the responsibilities of being a member and they feel like they are an owner.
And that's quite a good... I was just going to say, and that's quite a good way of co-ops having that sort of longevity, and because it's a renewal, it's not all falling on one person's shoulders who may well decide, well, I want to relocate to Cornwall. If there is a shared responsibility, that doesn't mean the whole project falls over because the one person with the who's the leaseholder or is the person who's got the agreement goes. It's got that. So co-ops, just to sort of put some of the sort of context of why co-ops are quite often a really good solution is that, you know, they do have that ability to renew and cope with changes in personality. It's a personality change. Changes in personnel, and you know, gives that sort of ongoing churn. It's not as disastrous as if the key person leaves. I mean, it gives other challenges as well, but that's kind of our role to help overcome.
I'm here for a specific reason, I guess, and you're leading me towards thinking about what that specific purpose may be. I can think of two specific situations, where this might be applicable. One would be the market hall, the traders there. The other might be, say, the leisure centre, mm-hmm. where there is an enclosed number of people who are employed there.
Yes.
From their point of view, I would be enthusiastic if their ownership of their enterprise encouraged them to deliver more interest than probably they have at the moment, being just employees with no vested interest in. Mm-hmm. And I can look at the market hall and think that the traders there know a damn sight more about retailing than I do. Or that any officers do, or any councillors do, unless they're actually involved in that particular trade. But the two are quite distinctly different.
They are, and they would be very different models, I would suggest.
Yeah. I mean, I go back to late 50s, early 60s, and whatever, and I looked at nationalisation.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me that what that consists of is just transferring the rule of the CEO from a capitalist enterprise to a socialist enterprise, where you've just changed the CEO from whoever it is to the Minister of State for that particular area. It leaves the employees in the same frame of mind, which
culturally,
the people who make the decisions are so far away from me that
am I going to
do? Yeah. You know, I'm just going to do my job and go home.
Yeah.
So, cooperatives or collaborations, which is a different word but meaning the same thing, if we're looking forward, we have a bit of a blighted country in that sense, that a lot of people are turned off. There was a report today about the number of people who are anti-establishment.
Yes,
and I think this is probably the alienation that they're feeling with regard to their power to to change things, even small things. So, have you come to us to talk about specifics? I mean, I know that on the Market Hall we've got a report which has been done by somebody else and what have you, and has all these proposals and what have you, but there is a situation there that could a cooperative might encourage the rebirth or the rejuvenation or however you want to put it, and I look at places like leisure centres and whatever, which we have an interest in, and think that might encourage individuals in the team down there to
and there's a very good working example at Greenwich Leisure, actually, which started out as a leisure centre that was due for closure, and the employees took it over and ran it very successfully, and that, to such an extent that they are now asked to go in and run other leisure centres. It works in certain circumstances with certain groups of people, and that is the key.
I mean, I'm pretty new to this, and I can listen to these informed people, I can take it on board and think, but this is a scrutiny committee.
Sure.
The main purpose of which I think is to scrutinise the policies coming out of the cabinet, and to pick flies in that if we can find them, or to congratulate them if they think it's a perfect job. How would we introduce this as a scrutiny committee then into mainstream policy thinking?
I think just as a reminder that our last scrutiny committee, I think there was a discussion regarding the sort of corporate plan objective you're referring to, and the committee felt it was appropriate to look at the benefits of the limitations of a cooperative approach to market hall management, and this is why we've invited colleagues in here to give that presentation. Because this would form part of the scrutiny review into a cooperative management of a market hall. I think the ambition is to have a report to present to Cabinet in December, which could sort of help influence or help sort of provide some guidance, provide some assistance to Cabinet's decision making. So you're right in the sense that the scrutiny committee is to scrutinise the Cabinet, but it's also there to inform and advise and support policy making as well. So hopefully that answers the question, Councillor.
I mean, I think if you're interested in how cooperative approaches could inform the council's agenda more widely, I mean, something you could ask the cabinet. This is obviously your remit, not mine, but something you could ask the cabinet to consider would be to look into the Co-op Councils Innovation Network, which is a network of local authorities around the country who are interested in these kinds of approaches across the whole range of different services, which, amongst other things, provides networks for officers in different authorities to be able to contact each other and share best practice and discuss issues in a kind of forum of like-minded folk. I mean, that's something you could ask the Cabinet to consider. I don't know how, you know, whether they would welcome that or not, but...
Thank you. You talked a bit about the sort of kind of maximum collaborative. In the market at the moment, there's probably around about 5 traders, permanent traders in the market hall, and then there's some pop-up stalls as well that come in on the weekends. Would you suggest there's a minimum amount of market traders, or what, 2? Okay. So,
I didn't remember the question, but it's gone now.
I mean, I think something that you know, you as councillors and the authority generally needs to consider, and I mean, forgive me, you may well have done, is the extent to which you see the market hall effectively as a property asset which can generate a bit of rental income in what are difficult times for local government finance, or to what extent you see it as an asset that can be used to bring the community together and to generate exciting stuff, you know, spaces for people setting up businesses to have a go without a huge financial risk and outlay. And those aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. I mean, you can ask the same, I don't know if you've got allotments, but you know, you can ask the same question about allotments. You know, are they basically a source of rental income for the council, or do you see them as a sort of, you know, fundamental part of a sustainable community for the future? But I think it's worth, I mean, I always think in organisational structure, it's the same principles that I think William Morris, you know, argued that we should apply to designing physical objects and buildings. Form follows function.
Thank you.
It's flashing.
So I've got three questions. So, on the first one, how
do you find members getting over the fact that they will be paying additional on top of their rent when they're potentially services that they already get for free now? So, for example, Market Hall at the moment is subsidised by the council to the tune of around £80,000 to £160,000. Pounds a year, in which it's running a deficit based off rental incomes and so on. As part of that, then they get kind of marketing support from the council and various things there. They also get things like maintaining and cleaning services and so on. Given that traders now lowercase estimate of £80,000, it's around £16,000 per trader to kind of cover that deficit. So how do you kind of find the traders in this instance kind of coming over that they now they just have to start taking the burden themselves for services they're already getting? Kind of linked onto that is, how much of the success of these models do you find based on the current members and the proposition? So, for example, in the example of Burton Market Hall, where we've got kind of five traders, historically there's been upwards of 20 or so if you go years back and so on, and arguably it's at kind of an all-time low in terms of participation, depth of offering, footfalls and so on. Is there a point where you could say it's past the point of no return for a cooperative model to start working, and you would need to do work beforehand to get it in a position where you can then adopt a cooperative model to take it forward the rest of the way? And then the final one, again kind of linked into those two, is what kind of training and upskilling is there for the members of that cooperative? And is that kind of part of that governance structure and kind of the package that you would offer kind of with the council and so on? Because obviously a lot of these are, like you said, sole traders or people who've never kind of had to do management of a building or service themselves. They may also not have time necessarily themselves with balancing their own business. So kind of what support packages kind of longer term are kind of put in scope with those storeholders?
So, I think in terms of the kind of financial viability when you've only got five stallholders, I mean clearly the long term solution, if it can be delivered, is that you get more stallholders that you can spread the cost between, and then you know if they're bearing the cost, they've got an incentive to get other people to come and join them. Now that's clearly a pretty difficult sell when you're talking about the level of subsidy that you've just alluded to. I mean, one approach would be to say that the local authority was prepared to continue with a level of subsidy, but that you tapered it over a number of years. So, I mean, if I give you a different example, Jane and I are both board members of a retail co-op society, which has a sports and social club in Leicester, which we used to give a substantial annual grant to, as well as having the use of the sports facilities in the clubhouse free of charge. And we decided that that just wasn't... It wasn't a good thing to do, but it just wasn't very fair that our members in Leicester had access to that subsidised service that wasn't available in the rest of the area that we cover. So what we sat down with the committee of the sports club and we said, look, we think what you're doing is great. We're very happy for you to continue to use the assets, but we're going to taper the cash grant over 5 years. And by the end of the 5 years, people had stepped forward and they'd come up with a business plan so they could actually cover their own operating costs. They're still getting the asset rent free, but that meant that we didn't have that revenue cost that we were then able to redeploy into offering member activities over a much wider area. So I think there's that kind of option. Having a building does make things more difficult. And I wonder whether the key to this is the extent to which you can get community buy-in, as in from more than just the traders.
The training, you asked about training and upskilling. Yeah. So, yeah, there is a package of training and upskilling, and that can be accessed through an organisation called Co-ops UK, which manages a scheme which is funded by the Co-op Bank, actually.
Even though they're not a co-op anymore.
It's 5 to 6 days of training and support. And that can be delivered by CASE, the organisation I work for, or Co-op Futures, or there are a number of sole traders, supporters who are affiliated to, it used to be called the Hive, it's not called that anymore, I can't remember, but it enables organisations to access specific training and support, and they can choose who that provider is, and that would initially be paid for by this package of support from the Co-op Bank. And what we find is that once people have got going, they're pretty self-sufficient. That's kind of part of what a co-op is, that people have self-help and self-responsibility. But then they have the opportunity to buy in additional support, and hopefully by that time they're generating, it's a viable business, and like all businesses, it's generated a bit of a surplus that they can use to buy in additional training or buy in a manager if that's what they need. If they're busy running their own stalls or businesses, that's very often a co-op solution. They employ a manager or an administrator or secretary or whatever.
That's a problem. So the only point that kind of was important is, have you ever seen any examples where the existing one is kind of past the point of return?
So I think that's a really good point, because you would sit down with the five or what have you and look at the business plan and look at what all the external factors is. So if the subsidy of 80 to 160,000 is ending January 1st, 2024, then that the business plan would have to account for that. And if you're saying, well, by then you need to have about 25 stallholders to cover the costs, is it a goer or isn't it? And the answer is, if there is the tipping point, is multifarious, really. If the subsidy was going to be tailored over a manageable period of time, and that kind of very often is part of my role, or encouraging with members of the group to enter negotiations with other stakeholders, like the leaseholder, to say, well, you've given this subsidy this long in the past. To make our business plan stack up, it needs to be X for the next number of years, and there's a little bit of negotiation to make it work if all parties want to make it work. But honestly, if there is a tipping point, I think it's my job to say, don't do this. If this is not going to stack up, if it doesn't work, calling it a co-op will not make something work that doesn't work with any other name. It has to be
a viable business.
It has to be a viable business. Yeah.
Yeah. Picking up on the comment by Councillor Clarke about the subsidy, I think we have to look at this in a different way. You could use the familiar phrase of it's been a perfect storm.
Yes.
Over the last, I don't know, 10 years perhaps. I think we ripped out all the fixed fittings of the market hall in 2018, was it, or 2015? Spent a good deal on putting a new floor in and putting the surrounds, not so much on the roof. And in a sense, the traders are being asked to support a historic building, which is 150 years old or whatever, and being asked to bear the cost of that when their function really is just to find somewhere where they can sell their goods.
Yeah.
If it was a new building, then that perfect storm wouldn't exist because they would have moved in whenever. Recently they've been interrupted in their ability to trade by the sanction of waiting to find out what we're going to do with it. So
yes.
Leases haven't been renewed or are only renewed up to 2024, and this has had a consequence of the numbers of people who've declined to invest any further time or money, and move to the Octagon Centre, where the new owner has made it financially attractive for them to move. So the idea that they need to bear responsibility for what is an old and decaying building, by its very nature it's decaying because it's much the same as Anglesey, same age and whatever. These things were never really designed to last 400 or 500 years, and need input every now and again into it. So subsidy, I think, is the wrong word. They have to bear an extra cost, that's for sure, because the only way the council has of getting a return out of that is by charging the rents for it. Now, the problem is that there is only 5 or 6 of the permanent stalls that are let at the moment, and there's something like 8, 15, I think it is, that are empty. Now, we charge up to £600 a month for them, up to, I don't know how many actually pay that amount, perhaps none of them. But in the sense that we're expecting them to have sort of run the management of the the market hall, to the degree that where it's not a burden on the taxpayer, or the council taxpayer, back onto the budgets of the... I think is a little bit... Well, I don't know what word to describe it. It's misfocused. And we're not really seeing it clearly for what it is.
I think the thing is, Mick, we've asked Richard and Jane to come in,
yeah,
to tell us about the cooperative model.
Yeah.
So we can look at it, because we all wasn't really sure what it was. So
what the guys opposite are trying
to do. Yeah, have you got a question?
See where this fits into our bag of tricks. And in that sense, the market hall is an obvious focus of interest. Now,
have you got a question for Richard or Jane?
Well, that was it. How do you deal with this, where markets have to move into historic buildings?
What I would do, if you were asking me, well, you know, what would you look at? I'd look at what does the council want out of this? Do you want an old historic building, which is an asset at the moment? It's in
liability.
An asset and a liability. But, you know, what do you want that space to be? And then it's kind of what does the community want it to be? Because very often people feel very passionate about about things that are owned by the community. What's the council doing with this? What are they doing with that? And so it's about what the possibilities are of a space like that. Is it you know, a liability that everybody just wants to go away, or does it have massive potential to be? And very often, when we don't know the answer to that, very often we don't know the answer to that. And if I look back to other sort of projects that I've worked on, the way to find the answer to that is to ask the question: What do people want of it, and what are the possibilities? And sometimes, you know, you set a hare running, and you don't quite know where it might end up, but it can be really, really interesting. The other thing is the sort of part of what our role is very often people go, are we going to get a management company? Is it going to be, are we going to sell it to a private individual? Are we going to keep it in public ownership? And very often the cooperative model isn't explored or even known about. And that's kind of where we're at, really. Just putting another idea. Is there a different way of doing this which could, you know, answer or find a solution that isn't answered through public ownership or private ownership or nailing the door up?
I mean, it strikes me that we're talking about a significant investment, I won't use the S word, a significant investment of public funds in keeping this facility operational. Now, if you think about, if you reframe the conversation to be about, well, we've got this amount of money that we're willing to spend, what are the different ways we could spend it? I mean, it strikes me that forgive me if you may be on with this already, but I mean, it strikes me that one thing that you could consider is perhaps working with Burton College or some other partners on thinking about those vacant stalls as incubator spaces. If there are young people who've got ideas for new businesses who want to have a go, you know, you could have a very flexible rent, maybe taking a cut of their sales, or maybe, you know, 75% discount for the first year, 50% for the second year, 25% for the third year, something like a tapered thing to give people who've got an idea for a business. It doesn't even have to just be young people either, but people who've got a bright idea who can try it out in a relatively low cost, low risk way. And if that means that there's more things happening in the space, that should help the existing traders to become more viable and then actually enable you to let more of the vacant stalls on a commercial basis. I mean, that's not so much a cooperative solution as just a different way of thinking about the management of the asset. My other observation is, I mean, I've not been privy to the kind of cabinet papers or any of the other things that have been going on for the last few years about the building, but I did have a look at the Burton Mail's coverage of the market hall over the last couple of years, which is quite extensive. And one of the conclusions I drew from that is that the people of the town are really passionate about the building. They might not agree on, you know, what the future of the building should be, but people feel really passionate about a community asset that they feel, you know, is part of their town and part of their identity and the identity of the community. Now, if there's a way that can be captured, I mean, that's basically the Radcliffe model. It's a community benefit society, so it's like a co-op in as much as it's democratic and it's accountable, but rather than just being for the benefit of the members, it's for the benefit of the whole community. And membership is open to anybody who wants to access the services, whether they're traders, whether they're customers, whether they're just concerned local people.
I think you've just covered it there, but we've got to look at it separately because of that building. You know, the people of the town love that building, but we cannot expect market traders to have to upkeep that building. So we've got to try and separate it somewhere.
Jane's been doing some work in Colville, looking at a future for various historic buildings there, and I think the Architectural Heritage Fund is one potential source of funding.
Yeah,
Yeah. And the interesting thing in that model is that that source of funding isn't available to public authorities, local authorities, but is available to a cooperative that is legally constituted, because they make the application to the Heritage Fund. So big capital spending, which can be very daunting, and you can imagine that five market traders have been asked to take on responsibility of repairing a grade 2 listed building room or something, or whatever it is, might make the project dead in the water, suddenly becomes viable. So there are lots of possibilities, and it's quite, it can be quite exciting and innovative and interesting. And I would certainly encourage anybody to have a look at CCIA, the Cooperative Innovation Network, the Council Cooperative Innovation Network, because they are very solutions driven. I don't know if you will have heard of the Preston model. A lot of some of the ideas come from that, but there are other local authorities that are taking on looking at sort of seemingly intractable, practical problems and finding solutions in partnership. It is about doing things with people, and there's the rub. I mean, we might get very enthusiastic in this room, but unless there are groups, there are people out there who may well attend a meeting, and we want the local authorities to do this and that and the other with the space. Right, are you going to come step forward up and be part of a steering committee? Everybody won't maintain eye contact, and it kind of doesn't happen, which is what I mean by, we can talk about solutions that will fit the same problem, but in a different town, it won't work because they are different people and people are different. Stay to me, obviously.
Nice, good work. So it's quite unusual for us to have experts of your calibre in the room, so I'm going to make the most of it. So it feels like we're in a slightly unusual situation in that we've got a building, everyone loves the building, we just have to find a good use for it. At the moment, we don't have a grassroots movement that are pushing for a cooperative. This would be a borough council artificially constructing a cooperative. Is that a risky thing to do, and what steps do you think our cabinet should take if they do decide to go down that route?
I've had experience where it's happened before, but have you, Richard?
So I think cooperatives grow out of communities, and I think that the council can do things to foster. I mean, there is clearly a community of interest. It's not very well organised. I mean, from what I gather, there was a grassroots campaign against the proposal to move the library into the space. Now, campaigns against things can be quite different from campaigns for things. But they do bring people together.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your experience been?
I think the answer to the question is we don't know until we ask the question. So an exploratory, an openness to the potential would be a good start. I mean, there are lots of councils who don't make this step about exploring the options. It's just like, that cost £180,000, we've got to make massive cuts, shut it, move on. And, you get a few angry letters to the local paper and sort of moans and grumbles and that. So this has been a start, and it's where it goes from here is really kind of, I guess, up to you. But I think where... you've talked about only five market traders. I would say there is a core there to say, well, what do you want? There is an option, the Octagon Centre, which, may be very, very interesting to such a point that they go, yeah, we're warm and happy, right, and there's a toilet, and that's it. And that would be that. But I think Richard's right. The sound and fury about moving the library, no, that's not what we don't want. Well, you know, is there room for a public meeting of just like what we've got here, but multiply it by however many and invite people along, and perhaps we can facilitate that to ask pertinent questions and see what comes of that. That very often that's where the start of ideas come from, and you know, campaigning and I've seen them grow through things like crowdfunding. You know, a little bit of crowdfunding to get an idea together. Can we? And it's really not about money. It's about people who are interested, and they'll buy a badge, save our market for. But that's the question of why, and what would make them step inside that market? What, you know, and who are the other partners who might be interested? You know, maybe the Chamber of Commerce or the local college or people who are potential partners with the council, who have that same desire to see Burton on Trent thrive, but have different perspectives and ideas on making that happen, and residents, you know, people who vote for you or use your services or whatever.
I mean, I don't know. Do you have a business improvement district?
I did. No.
No. I mean, they can be quite controversial,
yeah.
But they are a way. I mean, they are a way of generating revenue for activities that support the business community in a neighbourhood. Something else that occurred to me was, I mean, I think back in the 90s, I don't know if they're still going, but some local authorities were kind of grappling with regeneration projects and proposals for new housing and the kinds of things that can really generate a lot of more heat than light, shall we say, in terms of public engagement. And there was a charity, I think they were based in Bristol, called Planning for Real, and they brought together groups of citizens in an area and said, you know, we're going to take over probably a room bigger than this. Here is a model of your community, and we're going to spend a day basically running a giant workshop where we together construct a vision for that community in the future. We discuss, you know, are we going to have housing, what's it going to look like, where's it going to go, what are the pros and cons, what about green space, what about schools, what about infrastructure. So that rather than having, and this is not in any way to denigrate professional planners who have a very difficult job to do, but it's effectively kind of democratising the planning process and saying, well, actually, we're all experts on our local community. We all care about our neighbourhoods. And what does the future of this place look like together? Now, whether you could, well, I think you could run a workshop like that for, you know, the Civic Quarter or for the Market Hall or a kind of specific kind of iconic asset, if you like. Mm.
Yeah, I'm still a bit unclear as to what we're attempting to do. I guess if we got a report from the Cabinet, we could chew over that, but we haven't. But I do know that the party that now has the administration apparently pledged to form a traders' cooperative as one of the first things that they would do with regard to reinvigorating the marketplace, the market hall. Of course, the marketplace is part of that. And I don't think that's been done. So, yeah, I wonder, you know, if we're going to have a consensus of opinions of this committee, which is analysing what the administration does, and this, we want no politics, in a sense, involved. We want the best comments possible on what has been prepared and shown to us. And we operate on behalf of, you know, the electorate as to trying to pick holes in it and improve it. The same way as amendments are put at full council with regard to motions. It's an attempt to improve what's given to us. So
You know, the fact that there's only five there is really unimportant. The fact that it is important is that they're only contributing something like 200 quid a, you know, a month or a week or whatever into the coffers of a really tight budget, which is described by Councillor Clark as, I don't know, what was the phrase you used? Subsidising. We're subsidising the traders. We're not really subsidising the traders. They're helping us to pay for this building that if we decided to bulldoze it down and build houses on it, there'd be a bigger outcry than ever. So somehow we've got to rationalise through that and come up with a pressure onto the Cabinet to go the best way we think is possible.
Sorry, Councillor, could we just sorry if it wasn't clear earlier on. So previously the idea of this review was to, I think, gain an understanding of what a cooperative model would look like, and then as a committee then present a report to Cabinet with some potential recommendations once the committee has understood what a cooperative model looked like, perhaps undertake some consultation with, you know, stakeholders as well. So as you said earlier, we are here, the committee's here to scrutinise the executive, but it's also here to advise on service and policy as well. So I think that's what the aim of this particular review is to gain an understanding of the model, the cooperative model, and then potentially provide any recommendations to Cabinet which could help and advise them on their service.
This is the second scrutiny committee I've been to where the same subject was on the agenda. You know, the market always says it's at the top of our committee. And in that sense, we should be asking questions about it. You've invited these two experts to give us a briefing, which in a sense is guiding us in a certain direction. And I have to look at the top of what the committee is, and I'm thinking, well, not at all. It's, you know, it's regeneration, cooperatives. Yeah, but that's a huge thing. Marketplace, market all this place down there, it's got five traders in it, and it costs the borough, I don't know, what is it? What's the thing? 50,000 a year, isn't it? And coming up, we've got 300,000 quid, I think. Have you seen the report? Yeah. For roof repairs, this is a big mess.
Again, the focus of this particular review is just on this. Obviously, as the committee, we'll have a scrutiny programme with a number of topics which span across regeneration and the market hall. And I think the focus of this particular review is on that cooperative model. You know, to get awareness of what it is, what it could look like, what the benefits and limitations are. And then, hopefully, as a committee, we can provide a report to Cabinet with recommendations and advice, which will assist them in their decision making as well.
Can I ask a point of information question, which is, so we've talked a lot about the market hall. Do you have any outdoor markets? And are there any outdoor market traders, or is it simply those five people inside the market hall?
We have got some outside market traders. I think there's about, well, there's Burger Van and that, and then there's a fruit and veg store, and they've been there a while, and I think there's a plant store. There's a few outside. So obviously we're just looking at this idea of a cooperative and to go forward.
The reason for asking that was that most of the trader-run markets that the National Market Traders Federation have been promoting, the examples I can find are mainly outdoor markets, and I think that's probably because, for the reasons we've discussed, you know, taking on the responsibility for a substantial property asset is quite a big responsibility. But if one of your challenges is around generating footfall generally in the town centre, and the fact there are only five market traders inside the market hall, I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't have a cooperative model that included the outdoor traders as well. who may have a common interest in having a busy, thriving market that has lots of customers. I mean, that's just a thought.
Thank you. So I've got a couple of questions for the team, and then I've got a suggestion for the scrutiny paper, because it seems to me that there's one very glaringly obvious question that's not been asked. That Dan, you talked about, you suggested that this is, you rightly pointed out, this is about advising Cabinet ahead of their considerations, deliberations about whether or not a cooperative model is the right thing to do, although it does seem like as if that kind of question has been answered. So the question I was going to ask the team is, have you got any examples of cooperative-run market halls that are in similar places to Burton-on-Trent, so towns of similar size? Because you mentioned the one in Radcliffe, which is great, it's in Manchester, has 3 million people on its doorstep. And so when one of the challenges that we've had in the past about with Burton is that there's been lots of good examples of where market halls, whether they're cooperative, private, or run by local authorities, that are successful, but they are mostly in places that there are millions of people on the doorstep, and there are only 170,000 people in Burton, and perhaps not quite 3 million people within a bit. Well, you'd have to travel quite a long way before you get to 3 million people. So that's been the challenge. So I was wondering if you've got any examples of where there are towns of a similar size that run successful cooperative market halls. And then one of the questions in the scrutiny paper that we've got is, can you give a general idea or a general comparison of cost between privately run market halls and cooperatives? Now, granted, you don't run private market halls, but I'm assuming, it's just an assumption, that you might have examples where you've gone to market halls that are currently being run privately, and you've extolled and sold the virtues of a cooperative run market hall, and presumably in that process you've gotten a good understanding. But just an assumption there. I'll come back to the suggestion about the scrutiny paper at the.
So I think in terms of practical examples, I wouldn't. I entirely get where you're coming from in terms of, you know, the kind of iconic food-led markets like in Bury, for example, in Greater Manchester, which I believe is still like authority run. As it, interestingly, I think it was run by a cooperative for a while in the early noughties, because I was on the Cooperatives UK board at one point, and I represented. Well, it was called Associate Others. I used to call it, slightly tongue-in-cheek, none of the above, because I represented the Taxi Drivers Co-op in Kent, the Federation Brewery in Gateshead, and I think there was a Market Traders Co-op in Bury. That's an aside. The reason that I think Radcliffe is quite interesting is because my understanding, and my Greater Manchester geography isn't brilliant, but my understanding is that Radcliffe is a smaller town within the kind of Lancashire mill towns conurbation. It's traditionally been very much in the shadow of its bigger neighbours, and the market hall was getting very run down, and I don't think the borough council were very interested, because it was like the peripheral part of the borough. Now, my understanding is that, I mean, Burton is a substantial, you know, it's a substantial town. I mean, you know, I grew up in North Cornwall. I lived in Norfolk for a decade before moving to the West Midlands. So I might have a different perspective on population size and density, perhaps, because of that experience. But in a sense, you're kind of, I hope you won't take offence. I mean, I think Burton can be a little bit in the shadow of Derby. So I'm not sure that, you know, I think there are analogies with Radcliffe, actually. In terms of other places, I have been looking, but as I say, most of the examples I can come across are outdoor markets that are run purely by the traders. In terms of privately run market halls, most of the ones I'm aware of, and I mean particularly in Birmingham, for example, are actually, I mean, they're entirely private. They've never had anything to do with the council at all. Because other than you know, the big markets in the centre of Birmingham, which the council run, most of the suburban areas have a market hall, but they're just run by private landlords. And I think there are a handful of landlords who have like chains of market halls, you know, four or six or maybe even more. My observation as an occasional customer is that they vary in their viability and they vary in the quality of what they offer. I'm not sure if that answers your question. I don't know what your experience is, Jane.
I worked with people who were tenants of an indoor market. Well, it was in not quite a market, it was an indoor shopping parade in Nottingham, and the landlord put the building up for sale, and there was a real fear that of who would buy it, and the control of rents and or what have you would disappear. They've got a good relationship with the existing owner built up over many years. So that was it was like a community buyout actually, where all the tenants got together to raise the money to purchase the building, and then to run the sort of the common parts so that they could preserve the individual nature, the independent shops that were there, because you know a great many inner city shops, as we know, they're kind of clones of each, and you don't know whether you're in Burton or Bristol because they've all got a Costa, they've all got a you know, they're very, very samey because the rents are fixed. So if you want that sort of individualism where sole traders or artisans are very often the sort of the model, you know, it could be quite an asset of individualism rather than the cloning or which is a bit derogatory, I don't mean that. But, you know, the Octagon Centre is... You know, I shop there because I know exactly what I'm going to find there.
But it could be anywhere.
It could be anywhere, but it's 6 miles from where I live, so that's where I come. So, you know, they can be a real... individual ones can be a real asset. Just as Richard said, they're very often open markets, which can be very much cheaper. They're boards and bit of canvas and... what have you. Indoor markets, you do get your expenses of maintenance and rates and so on and so forth, which just adds a layer of complexity to it. But then, you know, it is an asset. It is a community asset.
I mean, I think it's also worth thinking about the role that markets play in the kind of economic ecology of an area, if you like. Because I think, because the barriers to entry is relatively low, we were talking earlier about, well, I was raising the point about incubating new businesses. And there are examples of businesses that start on an outside market stall, maybe a couple of days a week, move to an inside market stall, trading more days a week, and then take on a shop unit somewhere. So they're able to, you know, people are able to build their skills and experience, they're able to build their customer base, and they're able to grow their businesses. And I think if you don't have in an area, if you don't have that kind of opportunity for people to move up, or indeed the other way, you know, if you've got a business that's been successful for many years but for whatever reason is actually shrinking, to be able to move from a shop unit to a market stall might be the difference between the business surviving or folding.
A technical point, if I may interject, sorry. What I was going to do is explain that the Derby comparison is totally wrong, because they're in actual fact following Burton, and they've destroyed their market, or they've just put a £25 million new roof on the top, and it's gone some way towards busting their budget, and they're in danger of being taken into custody like they have. So they've destroyed their market. They got rid of the market down the other end, which was, I think, the Eagle.
Yeah,
they got rid of that, and now they've got no market at all, because the traders that were in the old market hall, which is very similar to the on a bigger scale, it's just they don't seem to have made it work. The same as we're having difficulty in making ours work.
I mean, I think one of the Derby challenges is footballers in the centre. And I'm guessing football in the town centre is a challenge. Is a challenge for you.
With every town, I think.
I think it's kind of a blessing and a curse for Burton that within 45 minutes you've got most major cities in the UK, which means you're competing with quite a wide spread. I think it's been really great having you here. I think, echoing Councillor Locke's comments earlier about having the expertise in the field has made a really nice change on that. So thank you for taking the time to come here. I kind of echo Councillor Allen's point as well around if you have got any case studies that you can share for reading afterwards, I think they'd be kind of great to kind of feed into this as well.
Yeah.
I think there's probably two bits of action that I'd possibly suggest for the scrutiny as well and for Dan to potentially to facilitate. So one, I think it'd probably be useful for the scrutiny review to see the Market Hall Working Group's previous report and all the consultations that they had as well just shared around. Because obviously some of that consultation work had been done as part of that with various groups. I think it'd also possibly be useful to have for us to start looking and considering a breakdown of the market hall's budget, because just so that we don't confuse the idea of the capital and the revenue as well. Because I think if we did pursue kind of a co-op model, I think ownership of the building and custodial of that would probably stay with the council, and it's kind of the use of that building which I think would make the ideal case if you went down a co-op route or not. That's kind of, I think, what's in scope. And I think looking at then what are the associated costs within that budget, such as cleaners, market hall manager, staff, utilities and so on, but also then looking at what are those associated additional bits of expenditure that the market hall currently gets by being run as a broader portfolio, such as access to the marketing managers and so on and that, because then you'd potentially get to a point from a recommendation perspective that if there's going to be a co-op model developed, these elements of it would stay with the council. These are the elements you'd then look to get the traders themselves to kind of pick up. I think by having that detail and letting us kind of review that and kind of digest some of that will probably help the group come to some recommendations on it as well. So I'd probably suggest through you, Chair, and there are potentially two actions for Dan as well as kind of a follow-on based off the back of this.
I'd also like to ask rentals, what each rental the traders pay, because I know there's one trader that's got about 7 units. I'd like to know if he actually pays for them all compared to the others. Councillor.
I'll just Councillor Cox got us on to talking about the scrutiny review, I'll mention the question that I think is missing quite obviously. So the scrutiny topic and the review is about exploring the benefits and limitations of the cooperative model. And as we've sort of talked around subsidy or helping council providing a certain amount of money to keep it going, maybe that's okay. And I know that when I was the leader of the council, I discussed a lot, especially with the group, I think the group will remember this, that I didn't necessarily mind the council spending money on something. We didn't have to turn a profit. If it was doing something for the community, if there was a social benefit to it, talking about the market hall, if it was a draw to the town centre, the fact of the matter is that it's not a draw, there's very little social benefit to it. And whilst we saw a lot of opposition to moving the library into the market hall, and there was an uptick, there was counters on the market hall doors, there was an uptick in the number of people that was using the market hall for that period. The moment it was finally decided that the library wasn't going to move into the market hall, it went down again. In fact, it went down lower than what it was before all of that discussion. So I've always been quite concerned that whatever ideas anybody's got, or any group or any community group or otherwise, it can't work unless the community buy into it. So the question I think is missing is what examples are, using examples that are already out there, what benefit do cooperative models have on their communities where they are. So take Radcliffe, for example. How many people does it bring in? If it wasn't there, presumably they'll have counters as well that want to know where people are coming from, how far they're travelling, how many people are coming. So that kind of thing, because that's the difference between it being a magnet or not and being useful for town centre footfall or not. And then other things, perhaps some support groups that operate from there or have operated from there in the past. So operate from other market halls. What benefits to the community do they provide? So I think that question is kind of missing from the scoping paper, and I think it's missing because if we're thinking about how we inform cabinet how best to proceed or how we think it should proceed, that could be the difference between them saying actually we don't want necessarily to make a load of money out of this. We're happy to agree a budget of 100k circa every year, and that's okay because it provides a huge amount of social benefit. If the committee is happy to change the scoping paper and include that question.
I was just going to say, I mean, in terms of moving it forward, it might be useful if we have a chat and then put some proposals. That would be, we'd be happy to do that. And just as a thought from sort of as a two-way process, it's kind of what the council could also do to facilitate it. And I mean, you don't have those answers, and I don't expect them now. But what I would just say is, if there was, in terms of what helps projects forward, is that the building itself can be and is a huge asset. It can also be a liability. But the way forward is very often, if there is a willingness to give or assign a lease that has at least a 10-year lease on that, and that might be a little bit more for larger capital items. I'm thinking in terms of, say, an application to the Heritage Lottery funding, that the building doesn't have to be owned by the group that takes over, whether it's a co-op or whether it's a thing, but if there is a lease in place, then very often the lottery would fund a leased building. That's just something to kind of think about, what would facilitate and help it make it happen if something was to come out of a community consultation and you get 10 very enthusiastic, talented people who go, we have a vision, we'd like to see something come of this. We have civic pride or whatever.
I mean, if it's useful, we can certainly.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely right. So if like you say, if we don't find those people, then of course, like all this, we can make it the most financial success possible. But if we don't find those people with that sort of tenacity and enthusiasm to run it by themselves, then that doesn't matter what kind of financial degree poker we do. So that's good. I'd suggest that would be in the scrutiny report as well, as that regardless of how well you make it seem financially and all the examples you want, for like the enticement to make sure you've got those feelers, those consultations in place, a very robust consultation process and like workshops and that to go with all the financial examples that you can.
I mean, I suppose two things to say. One is that if you want the data about Radcliffe, for example, it's taken me a little while to get the contact because people have moved on, but I am in touch with the operations manager there, and they'd be happy to host a visit, but secondly, as long as it's not commercially confidential, which it won't be, I'm sure they'd be happy to kind of share data on football and that kind of thing. You can follow them on Facebook, and what I note is that I think what makes that project work is it's a multifunctional space. So during the day, it's a traditional market that combines the remaining traditional market traders with some kind of artisan and foodie and slightly more hipster stalls that have brought a new audience in. And they've then added to that evening like food-based like food court sort of street trader type catering offers, and it's also a gig space on weekend evenings. So I think with these sort of challenges, we're not talking about either or options, we're talking about both and to try and make something that works as a whole. And I forgot the other thing I was going to say, so I'll shut up for a moment.
Thanks for the opportunity. Great, thank you.
And it's always, can I just say, as a citizen, rather than not sadly of your borough, but as a citizen, it's always a pleasure to come to Burton. And you have fabulous, you don't need me to tell you this, but this building and the market hall and the kind of the civic quarter, I was saying to Jane when we were coming in, it's a fabulous architectural legacy. I know it's a challenge to keep them going, but you've got something really special. Well, I did want to come up against the infamous Burton Bollard, but we won't.
Right, guys, obviously then we'll need an additional meeting prior to the next scheduled meeting on the 13th of December to finalise the review report. So, we've got to do that first, otherwise it's not on my list. So a list of public executive decisions have been circulated with the agenda. Yeah, I'm right. Just to make suggesting a meeting on the 30th of October. Yep, sorry. Is that date convenient for everybody? You don't know. So shall we say that date and then you can let me know if it is convenient or not? Is that all right, Dan? 30th of October. Yeah. We've got the 13th of December for the meeting, but that's just a...
It was the 30th of October.
October.
Yeah, sure.
We don't want to be meeting in that.
Just on this point, it might be best if a range of dates could be offered round, and then we can discuss whether who can attend and who can't. On the item itself, it's about a scrutiny review update on this scrutiny review.
Yeah.
I'm just conscious that in the minutes from the last meeting that we had in July, we started the review with the intention of completing it within 2 to 3 months, so 3 months is next month. I was a bit disappointed that it took quite so long to get a scoping paper brought together in the first place. And so I'm going to ask what updates have been made on the questions in the scoping paper, what progress has been made, what research has been done, if anything at all. I'm not necessarily looking at you, Dan, but I know you're supporting this.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I mean, I think after the July meeting, obviously there's some holidays, so getting a people together, everyone together during that time was difficult. In terms of progress on the scoping paper, I think there's been the first sort of hurdle was the first hurdle. The first action was to invite the group in to discuss to provide an update. I think one of my questions was going to be before moving on to the next item is what the committee wants to do now. Because when we spoke at the informal meeting, we talked about a consultation on whether or not a sort of public space is about public spaces. Is there a need for it? If that's something the committee still wants to look at, then I'd appreciate some sort of some suggestions or questions. What type of questions people like to ask? Who they'd like to ask? And we can get a sort of consultation out in the next couple of weeks. We also talked about inviting the cabinet member, to the next scrutiny meeting as well to answer any questions the committee may have. So I think it'd be quite good if we do want to conduct any consultation on that subject, if we could get that out reasonably quickly so the cabinet member could answer any questions that come off the back of that consultation. I'll have to email after tomorrow to everyone as well, if people can maybe have a think over the weekend and get back to me. That'd be good. But yeah, sorry, George, from what you were saying before, no sort of research has been undertaken sort of since we've spoke about the scoping paper. I think only Councillor Locke sort of commented on the actual scoping paper itself as well. So
only one issue with that plan. I like the plan. If we do consultation, we ourselves have got tied in knots as to what a cooperative model is and the different types. We'd have to give people some kind of indication, these are cooperative models, what do you think? And that means we need the definitions of them. You might have to get those from the experts we've just had in the room.
I think as well, something I thought about is, you may have seen the comments which came out regarding the next stage of the Markle, and there's going to be a consultation undertaken, I think relatively soon, I'm not sure the timescales. And I wondered whether or not conducting a parallel consultation would cause confusion. Obviously, to us, we know the difference between what the function of the scrutiny committee is, but whether or not if we was to conduct parallel consultations on two very similar topics, whether that would cause confusion with the public. I'm not too sure the best answer to that, or whether you don't think that would be an issue, we just go ahead. I don't. I mean, that would be something we'd have to discuss. Raise that. Yeah.
On the suggestions I made around that extra question, is that?
Yeah, I think. I mean, from my perspective, I spoke to the colleagues as we left, and I suggested I'd ask that question because they didn't quite answer the question, which I hope they would there. But they have said as well, if anyone has any additional questions post the meeting, they're more than happy to provide a response. But on that point, George, I've made a note, so I'll ask them that and share that response with the committee when they respond.
Yeah, I think Councillor Locke's right. When we all had a different idea of what a cooperative model was like, and it was kind of nothing like what they said. Is well, a bit confused now. Yeah. So we'll go on to the next one now. A list of public executive decisions have been circulated to the agenda. Does anyone have any questions on any of these? No. Okay. So the date of the next meeting is Wednesday the 13th of December 2023. To confirm the date of the next meeting will be the 13th of December. We also discussed earlier about the extra meeting on the 30th, and it says note in your diaries, but we'll send that round for you to see if you can make that date. So the Corporate Plan Performance Report 2023-24, Quarter 1. So is that you, Dan?
Yes.
Thank you, Jack. The purpose of this report, as you've all seen it, I'm sure, a couple of times by now, provides a performance update on the progress at the end of the first quarter of the current financial year, so that's May to June 23, towards delivering the corporate plan, leisure services contract and the Towns Fund programme. I'll touch on the leisure and Towns Fund elements later in the meeting. So in terms of the corporate plan performance, there are 132 indicators in total, and each target is graded using the usual red, amber and green scoring system. Out of the 132 targets, 82 are green and 6 amber, 0 red and 44 are not yet due to be reported. Full performance information on all corporate indicators is available in Appendix 1, and within the report there is a summary for each corporate priority and cabinet portfolio. Paragraph 5.4 details the targets that have been given a red or amber status for quarter one, and an update is provided for each target. And the recommendation is to consider performance, which is at paragraph 15.1. Happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Dan?
This report I know would have been written a while ago, but certainly to this date. So on RADO 5, Washington's submitting a planning application in August 2023. I could go through each of them and ask, has that been done? Because it's September now, so it's either passed or failed. It's not in danger of falling behind. It's either yes or no now. So is it possible that Cabinet would have seen this and had comments on it on Monday as well? Is it possible to have an update on how any of these targets have changed since it was first circulated and first produced, and what has been done to bring these targets that are in danger of falling behind, not in danger of falling behind?
So is that for all those targets? I'll raise the question. I think obviously we're coming towards the end of Q2, so there will be a performance report on those targets, but I'll get an update on what's been done in the interim. I'll ask for that.
Do we read all
that?
Yep. Right, we have three items to consider in private, so I will now move that in accordance with Section 100A4 of the Local Government Act 1972, the press and public be excluded from the remainder of the meeting, as it is likely, in view of the nature of the business to be transacted or the nature of the proceedings, that there would be disclosed exempt. Information is defined in the paragraphs Part 1 of Schedule 12A of the Act, indicated in brackets before each item number of the agenda. Right.